Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting this show today by talking about some research on the glacial history of western Wisconsin, where the St. Croix River snakes through volcanic bedrock and small towns and farms. And we have a couple of guests who are involved in this work. One is Phil Larson. Phil is director of the Earth Sciences Program and co-director of the Earth Science Laboratory at Minnesota State University in Mankato. Professor Phil Larson, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
With us as well, Hunter Delikowski, one of Professor Larson's graduate students, and he is researching the geology of the lower St. Croix Valley. Hunter, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
They are 2 years into a five-year federally funded project to learn more about the formation and evolution of the Lake Superior Basins, specifically the St. Croix River Valley. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about the glacial forces that created the rivers and plains we see in the upper Midwest? Maybe you've paddled the St. Croix River or hiked at Interstate Park in Wisconsin or Minnesota. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Phil, let's start with you. You're on the south rim of the Grand Canyon. Now, is this research or is this pleasure?
Well, I did my master's and PhD at Arizona State, so the Grand Canyon has been a big part of my life for well over about 15 years now. And I'm out here actually because I lead a class out here for Minnesota State Mankato every spring, and I'm out here getting the class set up for next spring. To bring a bunch of earth science students out this way.
That sounds really good. And maybe tell us a bit about the earth science programs at Minnesota State University in Mankato. And I'd also like to know about that earth science or earth systems laboratory.
Sure. Yeah, the earth science programs are, there's two different major pathways in there for students to take. The first is sort of a interdisciplinary program where you learn about the connected systems of the Earth system. And so in other words, you can learn about weather, climate, geology, physical geography. You learn a little bit about all of these things and use them to become sort of the modern day researchers in the geosciences. There's a lot of practical application to that in the workforce where people looking at natural hazards, flooding risks, and that sort of things really can find a home out there and find a cool career for them to pursue. We also have an earth science teaching program where we train K-12 educators to get licensure in the state of Minnesota to be able to teach earth science. So that's basically what we're doing inside the earth science programs as of right now. The Earth Systems Laboratory is an interdisciplinary laboratory that is co-run by myself, an archaeologist at Minnesota State Mankato, and a soil scientist at Minnesota State Mankato. And we work together to train our undergraduate and graduate students in that laboratory, giving them hands-on applied research experiences.
That's pretty cool. And 2 years ago, you joined leading scientists from four other universities to study the formation and evolution of the Lake Superior Basin. Why is this important?
Well, I guess there's kind of two reasons. One is sort of selfish. I grew up in Prescott, Wisconsin, and so the St. Croix River and Lake Superior has always been a very, emotionally touched place for me. And so being able to tell the story of those places has been important to me, especially because growing up and going to places like Interstate State Park and, you know, the Bayfield area and Apostle Islands and the North Shore of the lake, they're just beautiful, stunning landscapes that really deserve the attention that places like Grand Canyon get, right? And so I wanted to be able to tell that story. The other part of it is that these places can serve as fundamentally important physical laboratories for us to understand the processes that shape Earth's surface. So understanding how glaciers function, how rivers evolve, how landscapes change over time, these are things that we can do within the Lake Superior Basin, within the St. Croix River Valley. And that was really the impetus behind going after a National Science Foundation grant with colleagues to try to actually understand these places. And basically, we can use what we find from these locations to build models to understand how other landscapes function in other places across the globe.
Yeah, you know, and just from a personal standpoint, you canoe down the St. Croix River and you're looking at the formations and you wonder, now, how the heck did that happen? And I think we just ought to know, you know?
Yeah, and I think to add to that, you go to a place like Interstate State Park and some of the, even the signage there is a little confusing about what actually happened. And really, we don't know. And we haven't for a long time. We've had ideas, but nobody's been able to actually figure it out because, to be honest and fair to the old researchers, we didn't have the techniques, the modern methods and the modern technology to really be able to get at high detailed data-driven ideas for how these landscapes evolve. So it's pretty cool to be able to do it now.
Yeah, absolutely. And your graduate students, your researchers, how are they contributing to this, to the this bigger project?
Yeah, so as a professor with a lot of crazy ideas, it becomes pretty impossible to do it all yourself. And my sort of primary goal in being a higher ed educator is to involve students and let them experience things hands-on, get these applied experiences where they actually do real science, answer real scientific questions. And so what I've done is sort of parsed out a bunch of the questions we've had in this research. And each one of them has sort of become a individual master's thesis. So a graduate student like Hunter takes over a portion of this project and really goes at it, where I can't, you know, with the time, the amount of time I have in the day with a two-year-old and a five-year-old at home, I just can't, you know, get there for everything. So Hunter has joined the group and has done an absolutely wonderful job trying to understand this particular aspect of how part of the St. Croix River Valley has evolved.
And Hunter, the focus of your work on this project, it's the lower St. Croix River Valley, which kind of, that's the border area between Wisconsin and Minnesota. I'm wondering, why is this area fascinating, so fascinating to you?
Yeah, so to begin, I just want to give us a little bit of context on why we chose that area in addition to its fascination. But to start, you know, a master's program is 2 years. So because of the time, we had to select an area for me that was both feasible and practical to study within my tenure here at Minnesota State University, Mankato. So that area we chose was the lower St. Croix River Valley. And it's largely because regional proglacial lakes, all of them flowed through that area at some point. So we're focusing on an area south of that where we can kind of analyze the effects of all of those proglacial lakes and their drainage.
So glaciers carved that valley, right?
Glaciers did, in as well as flooding that occurred from these glaciers.
And this, I understand there was a vast glacial lake that once covered that, I guess, that flat plain that now surrounds the small town of Osceola.
Yeah, so the glacial lake that you're referring to is named Glacial Lake Grantsburg, and it's a bit north of that, and essentially it was formed from a small sublobe of the Des Moines Lobe advancing to the northeast and blocking the proto-St. Croix River, and a bunch of meltwater essentially ponded up there from various sources, and when that sublobe began to retreat, it's opened the floodgates, so to speak.
What are we talking about here when you say open the floodgates?
Yeah, so one of the things with proglacial lakes that is so interesting and powerful, both in a literal sense and a interesting sense, is that there is a bunch of stored meltwater, which gets ponded, and this often happens As the glaciers are retreating, this meltwater ponds behind the terminal moraine, or the farthest extent of which that glacier reaches. In the case of Glacial Lake Ransburg, there were multiple sources of meltwater that were entering Glacial Lake Ransburg. So to the north, you had the Superior Lobe, which was shedding meltwater and draining into the lake. You also had two smaller proglacial lakes to the northwest named Glacial Lakes Aitken and Upham. And then there is also meltwater from the Chippewa Lobe to the, it's the adjacent lobe directly east of the Superior Lobe, melting and flowing through the Nemecogon River. And then you also have meltwater from the Grantsburg sublobe itself. So all four of those features were contributing to pooling up a large body of water. And when this sublobe retreated, a lot of water came rushing down the St. Croix River.
It sounds like a lot of water would have come through. And we have any idea how much water would have poured through there?
As of now, because the margins of Glacial Lake Grantsburg are still being mapped, I do not know offhand.
Wow. So we have this vast lake. What other features of the landscape in that area were created by glacial events?
Yeah, so in addition to Glacial Lake Grantsburg, there were actually more proglacial lakes. There's Glacial Lake Lind, which occurred beforehand, and then shortly after Glacial Lake Grantsburg, there it was Glacial Lake Anoka. So a large feature around where Glacial Lake Anoka was is called the Anoka Sand Plain. So listeners familiar with that area, like Wild River State Park in Minnesota and stuff, will be familiar with the flat landscape around there, which is formed largely from Glacial Lake Anoka. In addition to some of the lake features and stuff, there's also paleo valleys, so old channels of which meltwater used to flow through, glacial features such as eskers, moraines, and a lot of other stuff like that.
Yeah, and what's the time frame here? How far back are we talking about here?
Yeah, thank you for asking. So there is issues when it comes to dating these features, which I can elaborate on. But the best estimates that we have at the time kind of place it roughly around 22,000 years ago to about 10,000 years ago.
In other words, a long time ago. How do we determine that?
Yeah, so there is multiple dating methods that we use. There is both relative and there is geochronologic dating methods. Things like radiocarbon dating. There's another dating method called optically stimulated luminescence dating. And then there's also cosmogenic nuclide dating.
So a number of ways that it is done. The whole business about the glaciers, the glacier lobes that you were talking about, to me, that's really interesting. Receding and going forward.
Yeah.
Sometimes at the same time, I guess.
Exactly. And if I may touch on that, one thing that is kind of a misconception when it comes to glacial retreat is that during the deglaciation of the Laurentide Ice Sheet, glaciers were both advancing and retreating dissynchronously. So sometimes you would have lobes advancing at once while others were retreating. You could have lobes advancing together or retreating together. So all of this makes the story very complex.
It is. As I was thinking about this, it kind of reminded me, and this is sort of off our specific topic, but the Hubbard Glacier in Alaska is still expanding at about 80 feet a year, and it has been expanding for the last 100 years, more than 100 years, I think, while so many other glaciers that we have are quickly receding, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you're correct. I'm not familiar with the Hubbard Glacier itself, but things like microclimates and different things like solar insolation, all of those have effects on glacial advance and retreat.
Really interesting. Talking today with a couple of guests as we look at what is going on in the way of research by the Minnesota State University Mankato graduate student Hunter Dellekowski and his academic advisor Phil Larson, who's director of Earth Sciences Program and co-director of Earth Systems at the laboratory, I should say, at Minnesota State University. Questions for them? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. What would you like to know, or what experiences have you had in that area? Love to hear from you. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my two guests from the University of Minnesota at Mankato. Two guests, as a matter of fact, for you. Hunter Dellekowski, graduate student there, and Phil Larson directs the Earth Science Programs and co-directs the Earth Systems Lab at Minnesota State University at Mankato. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. There's what I thought was kind of a cool, I guess we could better say unique deposit of sand and rock in that area around Osceola. It's called the Osceola Bench. What do we know? What is it, and what do we know about the Osceola Bench?
Yeah, so the Osceola Bench is a name that was coined by Mark Johnson, a glacial geologist. He named it in his Polk County Surficial Geology Report in the year 2000. Essentially, the Osceola Bench is a large flat surface. It takes up about 17 square miles. The northern extent of it is the village of Dresser, Wisconsin, and the southern extent is about 3 miles north to northeast of William O'Brien State Park in Minnesota.
And how was it created?
So this is kind of the crux of my thesis here, but Johnson describes it as a river terrace-like surface. And for those that might not be familiar with what a river terrace is, it's essentially a former floodplain of the river. The Osceola Bench specifically is comprised of glacial till and outwash, sourced from the Grantsburg sublobe, and sandy to bouldery stream sediments that are overlying Ordovician limestone outcrops. And the Ordovician is a period which occurred from about 485 to 444 million years ago.
Wow. So your research, you're studying the sediment below the surface, is that correct?
Yeah.
How are you doing that?
So there is a number of different techniques that we're using. First and foremost is physically looking at the sediment through methods like hand augering. So it's exactly what you'd expect, right? We go out there with a pole and a bucket and auger into the ground. And then there's also coring methods. So we use a device called a geoprobe, and it pushes a 1.75-inch diameter core into the ground. And you can extract these core logs and then split them open and get a visualization and a sample for what the sediments are like in the subsurface.
And go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to mention that we also use ground penetrating radar. And I don't want to touch on it for too long because I know that you had actually had a conversation with Dr. Harry Joel at University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. But it's a way to visualize the subsurface by shooting radio waves into the ground and essentially making a profile based on the reflections. And then finally, we have X-ray fluorescence, which is In short, you can kind of think of it as a chemical thumbprint, which represents the provenance of the sediment.
Really cool. Philip, what are other methods are your graduate students using in this research project? Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, so, I mean, Hunter kind of nailed the suite of methods he's applying, along with the geochronologic dating methods that he mentioned before. And this allows us to sort of describe and characterize the deposits we're observing. We also then can date them to figure out how old they are. We can use the XRF to figure out where the sediments are sourced from. And so those things together sort of create a cookbook, if you think about it that way, like a recipe to understand a landscape. And the one last piece that I would add to it is we also heavily rely on remote imagery like LIDAR, which gives us elevation data, and satellite imagery, which gives us imagery of the Earth's surface where we can look at the forms on Earth's surface. So Hunter and I are what we call geomorphologists who study the forms and shapes of Earth's surface and try to understand the processes that shape them. And so it's very important to characterize these forms and shapes that we're observing and relate them to one another to understand the processes that have gone on in those places, along with this kind of cookbook that we've applied. But we also have a lot of different other projects related to the Lake Superior Project, where every setting you go to is going to have a slightly different recipe, right? But largely, it can use a lot of the same methods with some tweaking, if that makes sense.
It does indeed make sense to me. Hunter, there's a quarry in Dresser, Wisconsin. It's called Dresser Trap Rock, and it's been in operation for more than a century. And the company that operates the quarry mines trap rock or basalt, which is a volcanic rock. I'm pretty sure. How did that large concentration, they've been working for over 100 years at this place. How did such a large concentration of volcanic rock find its way to Dresser, Wisconsin?
Yeah, so you are correct. It is basalt. And this basalt is sourced from the Mid-Continent Rift, which is largely responsible for the Superior Basin, as well as the pathway that the glaciers such as the Superior Lobe occupied and what is now the St. Croix River Valley, which occupies it. There is more information and stuff on the Rift Valley itself, but I would direct you to Phil for that.
Phil, what about it?
Yeah, I mean, I could chime in. Hunter's exactly right. So essentially, if the listeners are familiar with sort of the East African Rift or the Levant in sort of Israel and Syria, the idea is that the crust is literally sort of pulling itself apart in one of these rifting events. And there's a whole bunch of volcanic activity that occurs where the magma rises to the surface as the crust is literally ripping itself apart. But I want the listeners to understand, you don't have to worry about it now. It's not like a volcano is going to show up in the backyard in the St. Croix River Valley. So this happened about 1.1, 1.2 billion years ago, and it was a failed rift. In other words, North America tried to rip itself apart, and it failed. It got shut off, likely due to the birth of the Appalachian Mountains to the east. It actually smashed it shut. That's at least one idea. But this rift valley, though, has left what we call stacked volcanics, these layers upon layers upon layers, thousands of feet deep of volcanic rock, particularly amazingly exposed in the Lake Superior Basin, but also wonderfully exposed in the gorge, the St. Croix Dells at Interstate State Park.
And this rock is really hard, and I guess pretty, too, you could say.
Yes, I would agree. Yes, 100%. Basalt is very, very resistant to erosion. It's very durable rock. In general, volcanic rocks like basalt, but you can also think of things like granite. These are volcanic in origin. They're very, very difficult to sort of break apart. And so they tend to create stunning features in the landscape like we see at Interstate State Park, where we have these very steep-sided canyon walls. and very dramatic topography or relief features on Earth's surface.
Yeah, I've read that the rock is so hard that NASA was using it for testing drills on their moon probes.
That wouldn't be surprising. I don't know that for sure, but it wouldn't be surprising at all.
And how is it used in other than NASA? How is it normally used?
Well, I think the Dresser Trap Rock Quarry, a lot of that actually gets used in landscaping and in construction. You can see it in sort of pulverized versions of it in roads and things, but I think a lot of it is also ornamental. In fact, when you talk to people up there, it's actually kind of sought after and valuable, these big, what they call blue stones, yeah, that they pull out of some of that. And they are, you know, for those who like that sort of ornamental stuff in their yard, they are, I think they're cool. But I mean, I'm also biased as a geoscientist. I like rocks, so, you know.
Oh, man. Well, you mentioned interstate parks, and that's an interesting history because, well, first, maybe you could explain why it's called interstate park.
Well, it bridges both states, and so there's a Wisconsin side and a Minnesota side, and it's kind of rare to see that sort of collaboration between two states where they actually kind of work in tandem to preserve a natural feature like that. And like I said, I grew up in Prescott. I used to go up there all the time when I was a kid. And I think it's one of the gems of the upper Midwest. And for those who aren't familiar with it, it's worth a trip up there. And if you like camping, it's a great place to camp, especially if you have kids and stuff, wonderful hiking trails and great scenery.
Oh, absolutely. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, in Eau Claire County, has a comment or question, I think, for us. Let's go there. Hi, Vern.
Oh, hi. Yeah. So you got what's called a New Madrid seismic zone. That's the big rift. That's 5,000 feet deep. That created the three biggest earthquakes in U.S. history back in 1811, 1812. I should say four. Two on December 16th and then one on January 23rd and one on February 7th. Okay, it shook all 48 states. If you have an earthquake on that fault line, there goes your pipelines, your electrical. It's a $2 trillion disaster.
Phil, a comment on that?
He's exactly right. That's I used to teach a class called Natural Disasters and had actual entire module in that class on the New Madrid Fault Zone. So that's down by Missouri, southern Missouri, Tennessee. And there is concern down there that it could happen again. It's pretty unpredictable given the sort of intercontinental location of this, like in the middle of the continent. Many people are just not aware of the potential risk, and a lot of the infrastructure isn't quite built up to the same standards as, say, you'd get in California for something like this. So it is a very interesting place and a very dangerous one if that potential large earthquake were to occur again.
Norman emailed to say they grew up in Siren, Wisconsin, continue to spend time there, and Norman asked, how do glaciers and Glacial Lake Grantsburg involve the township of Siren, its current lakes, and Crex Meadows? That may be a hard one to come up with.
Yeah, so I am not familiar with the town. I would say that I'd have to take a look at it spatially to understand what the extent of it would be. I am looking at it now, and it looks like the town of Siren falls within the Glacial Lake Grantsburg Basin. So within it itself, that is where part of the Glacial Lake used to be. And then in addition to that, once the lake drained and the St. Croix River began to continually flow afterwards, Siren looks like it's within an old floodplain of where the river used to flow.
All right, so there you go, Norman. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I think on the Minnesota side of St. Croix River is at Interstate Park, people can see some of the more than, I think there are 200 potholes that were carved into the bedrock. What's known about how these potholes were formed, Hunter?
Yeah, so the potholes originally form when large boulders are plucked out of where they reside. And there is a specific kind of reason, which I can elaborate into kind of how the river takes advantage and is able to pluck these boulders. But when either a chunk of the rock or sand and gravel is able to essentially get trapped within that pothole, it will swirl around and erode and then weather the sides of these potholes. Almost think of it like a drill bit, which continually flows downwards as these flows are going over it, and they're very turbulent.
They're really cool. And I imagine, Phil, have you gone inside? There's one on, you can go inside one of those potholes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I've never been inside the ones there, but I've been in others in other landscapes. I can say that the ones in Interstate State Park are some of the most spectacular I've ever seen on Earth. And what's kind of interesting about that entire landscape is clearly, as Hunter's describing, you had incredible flows of water moving through that landscape to be able to do the work necessary to drill those potholes out. And the question is, what is the mechanism to actually do that, right? And so what Hunter's work is really focused on is, what did Glacial Lake Grantsburg do when it spilled out across this landscape in terms of altering the landscape over time? And then where does it fit in to that story of those potholes in Interstate State Park? And I would think right now, based on the data we're kind of coming back with, is that this is all after likely Glacial Lake Grantsburg drained, and likely from another large flood that Hunter's helping us try to sort out with another graduate student, coming out of what we call Glacial Lake Duluth, which would have been the predecessor of Lake Superior, spilling out through the St. Croix River Valley.
Very cool. Kitty and Hudson, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Kitty.
Hi. I'm just wondering, I live in Hudson, and I love to swim at the Prescott City Beach down in Prescott. And the St. Croix flows into the Mississippi just, so I don't know, not even maybe a half a mile south of that. But what amazes me is how narrow the river gets before it flows in to the Mississippi. Because, I mean, the St. Croix is such a big river.
And then it necks down, Hunter.
Yeah, so I believe what you're talking about is Point Douglas there. And the reason for that is it is essentially a hydraulic dam or a spit, which is formed from the stronger flows of the Mississippi, blocking those of the St. Croix. And that sediment gets trapped there and forms kind of a bar, which crosses right at the confluence near Point Douglas and Prescott.
Is that what you were after, Kitty?
Yeah. At first I thought he meant, you know, that I was talking about swimming at that beach. And I love the Prescott City Beach, which is has nice big old cottonwood trees on it, lots of shades.
Kitty, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. Ian in Duluth, Minnesota, we'll go to you. Hi, Ian.
Yes. Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to bring this really nice piece of music to everybody's attention. It's inspired by the geological action that happened however many billions of years ago to form Lake Superior, the Laurentian Divide, I think is what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
The piece of music is just called Laurentia, and it premiered last year at the DAC in Duluth. It's by a local composer, Wendy Durwachter, who's also our city councilor. And it's really a great piece of music. It's worth a listen. And and very colorful. It does evoke the North Shore of Lake Superior and all the great geology there. And you know, if you like Fantasia, I think you'll like it.
Phil, are you familiar with it?
I'm not, but I'll have to look into that. And one of our colleagues in the NSF project is actually a professor at U of M Duluth, too. Her name is Dr. Karen Grant. And so maybe she's more familiar. I'll have to check in with her to see if she knows anything about it.
And Hunter, you were going to make a comment as well, I think.
Oh, yeah. As a musician, I can definitely appreciate that, and I look forward to checking it out.
All right. Ian, thanks. And the title of the symphony is Laurentia, from the Duluth Superior Symphony. If you want to look it up, there you go. Gianni in Montello will give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I'd like to ask the guest, he believes there is a connection between underwater marine volcanism and seismic activity under our oceans. And could that be partly the cause of the rising temperature of our oceans around the world?
Big question. Phil, comment?
Yeah, that is a big question. I can say... with certainty, in response to that, that underwater or submarine volcanism does cause seismic activity. Any kind of volcanism does, because there's magma flowing through the subsurface and rising to the surface and then erupting. And you can imagine that movement and that force would create earthquakes. And in fact, if you look at a place like the Hawaiian Islands, where the newest, youngest Hawaiian island is still submerged and growing underneath the Pacific Ocean, there is quite a bit of earthquake activity out there. With the extra part of that question about how that relates to warming ocean temperatures, that I don't know enough about to be able to answer confidently.
Okay, Gianni, thank you very much for calling. Mark in Edgerton emailed, well, we'll get to Mark in just a minute. A reminder, we're talking today with Hunter Delikowski, grad student at Minnesota State University at Mankato. Working on earned his undergraduate degree in geology from UW-Eau Claire in 2021. Phil Larson, Professor Phil Larson, directs the Earth Sciences Program and co-directs the Earth Systems Laboratory at Minnesota State University in Mankato. Great to have both of them with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. The weather guys will be joining us at noon, but right now we're talking about how the Ice Age impacted the Wisconsin's St. Croix River Valley with Phil Larson, Director of Earth Science Programs at Minnesota State University, Mankato, and his graduate student, Hunter Delikowski, who's doing some work in the area as well. Questions? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Mark in Edgerton emailed to ask, did the glacial lakes that covered most of central Wisconsin drain through the lake at Devil's Lake State Park?
So this might be a better question for Phil. I would say that those glacial lakes that occurred in that area are outside of the range of the St. Croix River Valley. So I have not done a whole lot of research on those other lakes.
Yeah. Phil, what do you think?
Yeah, I can chime in on that one. That's actually one that's been pretty interesting. My colleague at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Andrew Wickert, and I, who kind of spearheaded this National Science Foundation project, have been also working on trying to figure out the story of the Upper Mississippi Valley for probably the last 8 years or so. We've been working on this. And part of that is looking at not just the St. Croix River Valley and what's coming down that pipe, but also what's coming down the Minnesota River Valley in south central Minnesota, but also what's coming out of western Wisconsin. And I believe the lake that the callers or the emailers looking at is Glacial Lake Wisconsin. And what we know about Glacial Lake Wisconsin is actually to the credit of the Wisconsin Geologic and Historical Survey. They did great work on Glacial Lake Wisconsin to try to determine some of the outflows of that lake and the timing of that lake. But they've also done work on the Wisconsin River as well, where that lake most likely put most of its water through, creating things like Wisconsin Dells. and so on. And that ultimately ends up flowing into the Mississippi and out into the Gulf of Mexico. The lake at Devil's Lake, I would have to look and refresh my memory at a map I don't have on hand to see how that would be connected if it was. But I know Glacier Lake, Wisconsin has a large sand plain that now exists out there that you might see as you drive the interstate down to Madison from, say, the Twin Cities. You drive right through where that former Glacier Lake once was.
As long as we're talking about water moving, Phil, today on the headwaters of the St. Croix River, they're about 30 miles south of Lake Superior. In the distant past, did glacial meltwater from Lake Superior flow that far or further?
Yes. So that is what I mentioned earlier about Interstate State Park. That is the outflows of Glacial Lake Duluth. Coming down those outlets. In particular, one of the other graduate students in the group is working on understanding one of the major spillways called the Brule River. Some of the listeners may be familiar. Absolutely gorgeous landscape up there. And we know that very large, probably catastrophic flows came out of Glacial Lake Duluth down that particular spillway. Today, the Brule Valley basically flows in two directions. One part of it is the headwaters of the St. Croix, and the other flows into Lake Superior today.
Yeah. A listener emailed to ask, how deep is the silt on the bottom of the St. Croix River? This listener also commented as an aside that the trap rock being mined is all used by railroads as well for track ballast. But what about the silt at the bottom of the St. Croix River?
That's a good question. I don't know if hunters stumbled on this either, but that was one of the next big steps we were going to look at in the work that he's doing, is trying to look at some of the bathymetric surveys or water below water surface elevation surveys and look at any coring that's been done in and along the St. Croix River Valley bottom. These flows did create a much deeper trench than the valley bottom is now. Today it has filled in with sediment since these flows went through. But it also depends on what part of the St. Croix River Valley we're talking about. So the depth varies in different locations, and this is likely due, as Hunter pointed out, to all of these variety of different large flows coming through. And they all kind of came through that lower part that he's working on, especially through what is called Lake St. Croix down by Prescott and Hudson, creating a very deep trench through that area.
Yeah. Someone else wondered, Hunter, how difficult is this work for a grad student?
Well, I guess that is up for interpretation. I'd say, yeah. Well, you got to remember, my advisor's on the line here, so.
You can be honest. It's okay. Be totally honest.
I mean, I think it's difficult, but I'm very passionate about it. That's one of the things I'm hoping that I convey to your listeners today. But with our work comes a lot of opportunity. So really the opportunity and the fascination and the love I've kind of discovered for the St. Croix really gets me through all of it. So,
well, it's a beautiful place. And Phil, the St. Croix River is designated as a National Wild and Scenic Riverway, if I'm not mistaken. And man,
yes,
it lives up to that designation.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Like I said, growing up on the St. Croix, and now it's kind of a joy to take a student like Hunter there and see him now looking at it going, man, this place is spectacular, you know, and really falling in love with it too. It deserves it to be protected. It deserves to be understood. And I'm just very, very, very happy that we get to be the ones to tell this story.
Yeah. Steve had emailed to ask if you could talk about the Niagara Escarpment. That's a you got a couple hours to do that.
Yeah, that's a big can of worms, but it's basically a carbonate escarpment that wraps around sort of the lower peninsula of Michigan, and it makes up Door County, kind of the relief of Door County in Wisconsin, but also wraps all the way around the lower peninsula into where we see Niagara Falls now today. And it's part of what's called the Michigan Basin. So the lower peninsula of Michigan is a structural basin where basically the rocks kind of make rings, concentric rings around the lower peninsula. And so that's kind of why we have this sort of arc of this carbonate rock that's very resistant to erosion, creating these spectacular landscapes that we see around it.
Yeah, very interesting. So the research, well, I'm going to ask you something, Phil, too, about what you've learned so far from the research Hunter and your other graduate students are doing along the St. Croix Valley. You've been at it
Sure.
a couple of years, but...
Yeah, and that's just when we've had money to do it. I've been out there, and so has my colleague at the University of Minnesota. We've been out there in the St. Croix probably 6-7 years, about the same time we started looking at the Mississippi River and trying to understand that story. And growing up there too, it's been, you know, a lifelong sort of observation of that river. I've learned a lot about things personally, about the appreciation for rivers and the landscapes they create and the beauty they create. But from the scientific standpoint, I think Hunter had a really great presentation at the European Geosciences Union last spring. And one of the things he kind of discussed was that the complexity of the St. Croix River, having all of these different events occurring, where all of these different floods are coming through and these glaciers are coming in and going out at different times, creates a really unique landscape to basically help us test really simple models that we have to explain landscapes and how they evolve. And I think the complexity that we're observing in this system helps us really tune the dials on those models and really make sure we understand that these models can help us predict what landscapes should do if there's large outburst floods, if there's large magnitude flows that move through them. And I think where that is exceedingly relevant is if you think of places like Nepal and the Himalayas, where they actually have glaciers retreating today, and there are large outburst floods that can wipe out villages in these valleys in the mountains. These sorts of understanding of process can help us mitigate risk and understand what will happen after these events occur in those landscapes for the future.
Yeah, that is very cool. And you've got 3 more years. And Hunter, you're going to be at this for what, another year?
So I'm only here for another semester. Currently, we've done all of our field research relating to the Lower St. Croix. Now I'm working on, as Phil had mentioned, using remote systems to do some mapping, and also kind of interpreting and collating the results from our studies to present and hopefully publish.
Yeah. And what are your plans for the future?
I would like to seek employment and just see if I could find what opportunities out there, and maybe potentially later on revisit going for a PhD.
Is he going to be able to do that, find a job, or maybe go on for a PhD, Phil?
I sure hope so. Most of the students, and this isn't me patting myself on the back, but most of the students come out with a skill set. Their work is hard, as Hunter admitted, and that's why I'm okay with them saying it. I don't hold it against them. It is hard on purpose to provide a suite of skills and thinking, critical thinking, that allows them to find a job in the workforce and really kick butt at that job, right? And absolutely, without hesitation, I think Hunter could go on to get a PhD someday and do great work.
Okay. On that note, I want to thank you both for taking time. Phil, don't trip and fall over the south rim of the Grand Canyon.
I'll try not to.
And Hunter, you be careful too. Thank you both so much. I really appreciate it. Maybe we can do this again down the road. Hunter Delikowski, graduate student at Minnesota State University in Mankato. And Phil Larson, Professor Phil Larson, directs the Earth Science Program and co-directs the Earth Systems Laboratory at Minnesota State University in Mankato. They're doing some really fascinating work, and it was fun talking with them about it. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be fun talking with our weather guys. They're up next to talk climate and weather. I'm Larry Mehler.